Hello, this is Janice Schweizer with the Pantograph for Tuesday, December 16th, 2025. We begin on the front page with Ag Chief, Tariffs Crushing Farmers. Trump, $12 billion aid pledge, not enough, Costello says. This is by Peter Hancock with Capital News, Illinois. The Trump administration announced this week that it would make $12 billion available in the form of one-time payments to U.S. farmers to help weather what it calls temporary trade market disruptions in the wake of ongoing tariff disputes with America's trading partners. But Jerry Costello II, director of Illinois Department of Agriculture, said this week the latest aid package is less than half the size of the one offered in response to trade disputes during Trump's first administration. He said the money being offered now is not nearly enough to make up for the losses farmers are suffering. Tariffs are crushing farmers again, Costello said in a statement. Financial losses are worse this time around, yet the aid package is 50% smaller. We've seen repeated devastation with greater losses than Trump won. It defies logic. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced the Farmer Bridge Assistance Program on Monday. It said the funds are authorized under the Commodity Credit Corporation Charter Act and will be administered through the Federal Farm Service Agency, which also administers most other farm credit, subsidy, and conservation programs. Of the $12 billion being made available, USDA said $11 billion will be earmarked for farmers who produce row crops. Those include corn and soybeans, the two biggest crops in Illinois, as well as barley, cotton, oats, peanuts, sorghum, wheat, and several other crops. The remaining $1 billion is being reserved for other crops, including sugar and specialty crops, although details of those payments are still being developed. The payments will be based on the number of acres of eligible crops each farmer planted, as reported to FSA, as well as statistical models that use production cost estimates, average yields, and market prices to estimate each farmer's losses. USDA said eligible farmers should make sure their 2025 acreage is reported to FSA by 5 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time on Friday, December 19th. Eligible farmers can expect payments to be released by February 28, 2026. In its statement Monday, USDA said the program would use a uniform formula to cover a portion of the modeled losses farmers incurred during the 2025 crop year, but it did not say how large of a portion those payments would cover. Costello, however, said the limited size of the program ensures it will not be enough to cover all the losses farmers have suffered as a result of the trade disputes. It's a much, much smaller relief package than last time, and this is a much larger problem than what we experienced during the first Trump administration and the first Trump tariffs, he said in an interview with Capital News Illinois. In 2017, Costello noted, the Trump administration imposed significant tariffs on various goods coming into the United States from China. That prompted China to impose retaliatory tariffs on a number of U.S. exports, including soybeans and other agricultural products. Illinois is the nation's leading producer of soybeans, he said, and China was the biggest export market for that crop. In 2017, tariffs were put into place. In 2018 and 19, there's an estimated loss of over $27 billion in the agricultural space, Costello said. What's interesting about that is about 72% of that literally was specific to soybeans, and about 95% of that was specific to China. So at that point in time, again, first Trump administration, the aid package was $23.1 billion. Costello also noted that nearly a third of the agricultural losses that time were concentrated in just three states, Iowa, Illinois, and Kansas. This time around, Costello said the global trade disputes extend beyond just China, and in the agricultural sector, they involve many more crops than corn and soybeans. But the aid package is only half the size as the one in the first Trump administration. Costello said the trade wars have affected the farm economy on at least two fronts: lower prices due to shrinking export markets and higher production costs because of tariffs imposed on imported goods such as fertilizers, tractors, and other kinds of farm equipment. During the first Trump administration, he said, Illinois' sales of soybeans to China fell from $1.3 billion in 2017 to $116 million in 2018, roughly a 90% drop. By 2020, they had fallen further to just $29 million. So, I mean, these are major, major losses, he said. One result, he said, is that farmers have ended up storing their products in silos, either because the market prices are too low or there simply aren't enough buyers. So when you've got all of your storage that's being consumed, or most of your storage being consumed, a lot of farmers are forced to sell into a market that's depressed if they have nowhere to go with it. So they're forced to take those losses, he said. Meanwhile, tariffs being imposed on products coming into the U.S. from overseas are driving up the cost for farmers to put a crop in the ground. Just this past year, because of tariffs, nitrogen tariffs are up 10%, he said. Herbicide, pesticide, insecticide are up 20%. Ag equipment up 13%, tractors up 16%. So there are huge implications because of the tariffs on a lot of the inputs. While those factors are affecting farmers' bottom lines today, Costello said his biggest concern is that they could become long-term drags on the farm economy, making it difficult or impossible for individuals and families to earn their livelihoods by farming. Right now, we have more people farming that are over 75 than under 35, he said. It's scary because 58.6 is the average age of a farmer in the state of Illinois right now. So getting new people into agriculture, retaining the folks that have had the guts to try to come into a tough, these new folks are the most vulnerable. And those are the ones that it worries me will not be able to sustain this type of downturn. Next, we have an article titled, Full Suffocation. ACA enrollees say expiring subsidies will hit them hard, by Allie Swenson with the AP. For one Wisconsin couple, the loss of government-sponsored health subsidies next year means choosing a lower-quality insurance plan with a higher deductible. For a Michigan family, it means going without insurance altogether. For a single mom in Nevada, the spiking costs mean fewer Christmas gifts this year. She is stretching her budget already while she waits to see if Congress will act. Less than 3 weeks remain until the expiration of COVID-era enhanced tax credits that helped millions of Americans pay their monthly fees for Affordable Care Act coverage for the past 4 years. The Senate rejected two proposals to address the problem. Thursday, an emerging health care package from House Republicans does not include an extension, all but guaranteeing that many Americans will see much higher insurance costs in 2026. Here are a few of their stories. Chad Bruins comes from a family of savers. That came in handy when the 58-year-old military veteran had to leave his firefighting career early because of arm and back injuries he incurred on the job. He and his wife, Kelly, 60, both retirees, cut their own firewood to reduce their electricity costs in their home in Sawyer County, Wisconsin. They rarely eat out and hardly ever buy groceries unless they are on sale. Though they have always been frugal, they will be forced to be even more so now, Bruins said. That is because their coverage under the health law enacted under former President Barack Obama is getting more expensive and for worse coverage. This year, the Bruinses paid $2 per month for a top-tier gold-level plan with less than a $4,000 deductible. Their income was low enough to help them qualify for a lot of financial assistance. But in 2026, That same plan will rise to an unattainable $1,600 per month, forcing them to downgrade to a bronze plan with a $15,000 deductible. Kelly Bruins said she is concerned that if something happens to their health in the next year, they would go bankrupt. While their monthly fees are low at about $25, their new out-of-pocket maximum at $21,000 amounts to nearly half their joint income. We have to pray that we don't have surgery or don't have some medical procedure done that we're not aware of, she said. It would be very devastating. Dave Roof's family of four has been on ACA insurance since the program started in 2014. Back then, the accessibility of insurance on the marketplace helped him feel comfortable taking the leap to start a small music production and performance company in his hometown of Grand Blanc, Michigan. His wife, Kristen, is also self-employed as a top seller on Etsy. The coverage worked for them so far, even when emergencies came up, such as an ATV accident their 21-year-old daughter had last year. But now, with the expiration of subsidies that kept their premiums down, the 53-year-old Roof said their $500 per month insurance plan will jump to at least $700 a month, along with spiking deductibles and out-of-pocket costs. With their joint income of about $75,000 a year, that increase is not manageable, he said. So they plan to go without health insurance next year, paying cash for prescriptions, checkups, and anything else that arises. Roof said his family already lives cheaply and has not taken a vacation together since 2021. As it is, they do not save money or add it to their retirement accounts. So even though foregoing insurance is stressful, it's what they must do. The fear and anxiety that it's going to put on my wife and I is really hard to measure, Roof said. But we can't pay for what we can't pay for. If you ask Caitlin Provost, the American middle class has gone from experiencing a squeeze to full suffocation. The 37-year-old social worker in Henderson, Nevada, counts herself in that category. As a single mom, she already keeps a tight budget to cover housing, groceries, and daycare for her 4-year-old daughter. Next year, that will be even tougher. The monthly fee on her plan is going up from $85 to nearly $750. She decided she will pay that higher cost for January and reevaluate afterward, depending on whether lawmakers extend the subsidies, which, as of now, appears unlikely. She hopes they will. If Congress does not act, she will drop herself off the health insurance and keep it only for her daughter because she cannot afford the higher fee for the two of them over the long term. The strain of 1 month alone is enough to have an effect. I'm going to have to reprioritize the next couple of months to rebalance that budget, Provost said. Christmas will be much smaller. Next, we have Immigration Crackdown Takes Toll on Child Care by Mariah Ballingit with the AP. Not long after President Donald Trump took office in January, staff at Centronia Bilingual Preschool began rehearsing what to do if immigration and customs enforcement officials came to the door. As ICE became a regular presence in their historically Latino neighborhood this summer, teachers stopped taking children to nearby parks, libraries, and playgrounds that had once been considered an extension of the classroom. And in October, the school scrapped its beloved Hispanic Heritage Month parade, when immigrants' parents typically dress their children in costumes and soccer jerseys from their home countries. ICE had begun stopping staff members, all of whom have legal status, and school officials worried about drawing more unwelcome attention. All of this transpired before ICE officials arrested a teacher inside a Spanish immersion preschool in Chicago in October. The event left immigrants who work in child care, along with the families who rely on them, feeling frightened and vulnerable. Trump's push for the largest mass deportation in history has had an outsized impact on the child care field, which is heavily reliant on immigrants and already strained by a worker shortage. Immigrant child care workers and preschool teachers say they are racked by anxiety over possible encounters with ICE officials. Some have left the field, and others have been forced out by changes to immigration policy. At Centronea, CEO Myrna Peralta said all staff must have legal status and work authorization. But ICE's presence and the fear it generates have changed how the school operates. It really dominates all of our decision-making, Peralta said. Instead of taking children on walks through the neighborhood, staff members push children on strollers around the hallways. And staff converted a classroom into a miniature library when the school scrapped a partnership with a local library. Schools and child care centers were once off limits to ICE officials, in part to keep children out of harm's way. But those rules were scrapped not long after Trump's inauguration. Instead, ICE officials are urged to exercise, quote, common sense. Tricia McLaughlin, spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security, defended ICE officials' decision to enter the Chicago preschool. She said the teacher, who had a work permit and was later released, was a passenger in a car that was being pursued by ICE officials. She got out of the car and ran into the preschool, McLaughlin said, emphasizing the teacher was, quote, arrested in the vestibule, not in the school, close quote. The man who had been driving went inside the preschool where officials arrested him. Under gun violence, we have Police Renew Search for Brown University Shooter by Kimberly Cruci and Amanda Swinhart. Police renewed their search Monday for the gunman who killed two Brown University students and wounded nine others a day after they released a person of interest after determining the evidence pointed in a different direction. Officials announced the man's release at a news conference late Sunday, marking a setback in the investigation of Saturday's attack on the Ivy League school's campus and adding to mounting questions about the attack and investigation, including a lack of video evidence and whether the focus on the person of interest might have given the killer more time to escape justice. Providence residents and students were relieved early Sunday when officials announced they detained a man at a Rhode Island hotel in connection with the attack and lifted a lockdown. But that relief was short-lived, as Mayor Brett Smiley said hours later that investigators didn't know whether the gunman was still in the area. We know that this is likely to cause fresh anxiety. The release of the person of interest left law enforcement without a known suspect, with officials pledging to redouble their efforts by asking neighborhood residents and businesses for video surveillance that might help identify the attacker. "We have a murderer out there," Attorney General Peter Nerona said. Authorities said Sunday that one of the reasons they lacked video of the shooter was because Brown's engineering building doesn't have many cameras. The mayor said there have been no credible threats of further violence since the shooting, and the city's schools were open on Monday. On Sunday morning, officials took a person of interest into custody at a Hampton Inn in Coventry, Rhode Island, about 20 miles from Providence. Two people familiar with the matter identified that individual as a 24-year-old man from Wisconsin, though authorities never released his name. "I've been around long enough to know that sometimes you head in one direction and then you have to regroup and go in another, and that's exactly what has happened over the last 24 hours or so," Nerona said. He said there was some evidence that pointed to the man authorities detained, but that evidence needed to be corroborated and confirmed. And over the last 24 hours, leading into just very, very recently, that evidence now points in a different direction. Authorities believe they are looking for a person shown in a small short clip of video footage walking away, the mayor said. The person's back is to the camera. Right now, we don't have any evidence to suggest it was more than that individual, Smiley said on Monday's Good Morning America. Despite an enhanced police presence at Brown, officials are not recommending another shelter-in-place order like the one that followed the Saturday afternoon shooting, when hundreds of officers searched for the attacker and urged students and staff to remain indoors. The shooting occurred as final exams were underway. The gunman opened fire inside a classroom in the engineering building, getting off more than 40 rounds from a 9mm handgun, a law enforcement told the AP. Two handguns were recovered when the person of interest was taken into custody, and authorities also found two loaded 30-round magazines, said the official, who spoke to AP on the condition of anonymity. Investigators were not immediately sure how the shooter got inside the first-floor classroom in a seven-story complex that houses the School of Engineering and Physics Department. The attack set off hours of chaos on campus and in the surrounding neighborhoods as hundreds of officers searched for the shooter. One video showed students in a library shaking and wincing as they heard loud bangs just before the police entered the room to clear the building. During the lockdown, which wasn't lifted until Sunday after the person of interest was taken into custody, many students remained barricaded in rooms while others hid behind furniture and bookshelves as police searched for the shooter. One of the nine wounded students was released from the hospital, Paxson said Sunday. Seven others were in critical but stable condition, and one was in critical condition. In the Veterans Corner, we have... The Department of Veterans Affairs has changed the processes used by women veterans to access gynecological care. Women veterans may now schedule appointments with VA gynecology providers without needing a referral from a VA primary care provider. Prior to this change, women veterans seeking appointments with specialty gynecology care had first to see their VA primary care doctor for approval and referral to the specialist care. This change is similar to access for all veterans to set appointments for hearing care directly with the audiology specialist without the requirement to see primary care provider to obtain a referral for hearing care. Browse, quote, VA makes it easier for women veterans to access gynecological care, close quote, at news.va.gov. For more information about these changes and others at the VA. The VA has opened 20 new healthcare clinics across the nation since January 20th. VA has offered veterans more than 1.4 million appointments outside of normal operating hours. These early morning, evening, and weekend appointments give vets more timely and convenient options for care. VA permanently housed 51,936 homeless veterans across the country in fiscal year 2025, the highest total in 7 years. VA has brought tens of thousands of employees back to the office, where it can work better as a team to serve veterans. It has partnered with Medicare and Medicaid services to identify and recover $106 million in duplicate billing. Currently, 20 members of the Senate are veterans and 80 members of the House are veterans. Veteran numbers in Congress have been on the decline consistently since 1973, although there has been a slight uptick in the participation rate in the last election cycle. What does this mean? Veterans, like every other constituency group, must be ever watchful and ever involved in the political process to ensure that veteran benefits are stable and improved as needed. Veterans cannot individually do the surveillance of Congress necessary to protect veteran benefits. Veterans Service Organizations, VSOs, like the American Legion, Veterans of Foreign Affairs, AMVETS, and DAV, have been at the forefront of the effort to represent the best interests of veterans relative to our governments at all levels. Yet many veterans do not belong to these organizations in the volume they once did. Remember, membership numbers represent potential voters, and the number of voters can influence government actions. Contact your local veterans organization. Membership costs are minimal, and the positive effects could be priceless for all veterans. If having difficulty knowing which VSO might fit your needs, contact the VSO post or your Veterans Assistance Commission office for help. And the quote of the day, Americans are bombarded with, quote, information, unquote, every day from media sources of all kinds. Politicians, television, radio, newspapers, magazines, internet, and social media sources seem to play loose with the facts. In the old days, most of us assumed that our limited resources of information were true, and we had no reason to question their veracity. Today, if you access more than one information source about the same topic, you are likely to discover that the various sources disagree about what is true, which then creates a difficult dilemma with which to deal. According to studies, lack of trust in the information we receive is at an all-time low. Lack of trust is at an all-time high. Countries who cannot trust their leaders and news sources eventually will not survive. Quote, "Whoever is careless with the truth in small matters cannot be trusted with important matters," spoken by Albert Einstein. And with packages, can you keep a misdelivered package? See what the law says. The holiday season is one of the busiest times of the year for online retailers, mail carriers, and package delivery services alike. As a result, mistakes are sometimes made. Everyone's had an experience where they excitedly picked up a package delivered to their doorstep only to read someone else's name and address written across the top. But is it a crime to keep misdelivered packages? What do you do if you receive one? Here's what we know. It can result in theft charges, although the specifics matter. Chapter 720, Section 16 to 28 of the Illinois Compiled Statutes says it's considered delivery container theft when a person knowingly uses a package meant for someone else without the owner's authorization. The crime is classified as a Class B misdemeanor under the statute, carrying potential fines of $150 for first offenders and $500 for subsequent offenders. Knowingly using stolen property can also be considered general theft under Section 16.1 of the statute. The classification and sentence for theft in Illinois varies depending on the value of the stolen goods. Federal law also applies, particularly when the U.S. Postal Service delivered the package. Keeping a package addressed to someone else is considered mail theft, according to the service, and is punishable by up to $250,000 in fines or up to 5 years in prison, according to LegalClarity.org. You should report a misdelivered package. First, contact the private shipping service, seller, or the post office to help you comply with the state statute requiring reasonable efforts to return a misdelivered package. It also helps the sales platform be aware of possible brushing scams that try to fraudulently boost a seller's profile and sometimes capture personal information about customers. And with that, we conclude the reading of Part 1 of the Pantograph for Tuesday, December 16th, 2025. I'm Janice Schweizer, and I will return shortly with Part 2.